Hello, book lovers. Welcome to Bookmarked. I am Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this podcast. We've got a huge one today. We've got the fascinating story of a bridge that begins in Scotland and goes all the way to America. That's with Travis Eldborough. We've got the brilliant poet and performer John Hegley. And we've got a conversation with the multi-talented Sophie Hannah. You might know Sophie as an award-winning crime writer or perhaps even as an award-winning poet, but she also has been working on numerous other projects. She does books for kids. She's working on a supernatural novel for the Hammer imprint, which is, of course, the legendary horror filmmakers. She does so many things. And so I started off this interview by just asking her, how does she keep up with it all?
It actually gets harder rather than easier, because when I was writing my first novel and even my second, there were no other demands on my time because I wasn't yet well known as a crime writer. So I could spend all my time writing. Nobody wanted to interview me. Nobody wanted me to do events. I mean, there were a few things like that. But all that side of it, the sort of public side of being a writer, has got more and more and more. So it actually gets much, much harder to find the time to write the book. And I do suffer terribly from stress and deadline anxiety. You know, I'm worrying already, am I going to get the new book in by the end of May, which is when it's supposed to be in? But actually the stress, I think, can be quite beneficial, because naturally I'm probably a bit of a layabout. So if I didn't have the fear of missing the deadline, I probably wouldn't focus my mind and be as efficient. So I think it's all good.
Could you tell us a little bit about the novel?
Well, the novel's called The Carrier, and it starts when the heroine, Gabby, finds out that her flight that she's taking from Germany back to the UK has been delayed overnight. And all the passengers are taken by coach to a hotel where they have to spend the night. And when they get there, the receptionist tells them that she hasn't got enough rooms for them all, and anyone travelling alone is going to have to share with a stranger. This is actually something that really happened to me. But in the book, Gabby, on hearing that she has to share a room with a stranger, feels a hand closing around her wrist, and an unstable, distressed young woman says to her, "You're sharing with me." And it turns out this woman is in a panic because she is somehow involved in a murder case. She mentions a man who's going to prison for the murder of a woman, but it's a murder that this young woman, Lauren, insists that he didn't commit. So she says, you know, this man is going to prison wrongly. He shouldn't be going to prison. And Gabby sort of investigates a bit further, asks a few more questions, and finds out that this man who's going to prison for the murder of his wife is actually the only man that she, Gabby, has ever loved. And then she thinks, hang on a minute, can this be a coincidence that this young woman is on my flight, has latched onto me, and this man she's talking about who's going to prison wrongly for murder is basically the love of Gabby's life? So that's the plot hook, and hopefully that will intrigue readers. The other sort of intriguing aspect of the plot is that when Gabby gets back to the UK, finally goes to the police about all this, she's told that Tim, the love of her life, has actually confessed to the murder of his wife, very willingly, but he claims that he didn't have a motive. Not that he doesn't remember what his motive is or he's not sure, but he says, I had no reason to kill her, I did it for no reason, now please arrest me and take me to prison. And the police say, hang on a minute, people don't generally just kill people for absolutely no reason. So that's another mystery, and Gabby is desperate to solve this mystery, get Tim out of prison, but also as she gets more and more involved in the goings on, it kind of reawakens her love for him that's been dormant all these years. And so it's kind of a love story as well as a psychological thriller. So that's the top note. But in terms of the themes, I mean, really what I wanted to look at was kind of the battle between good and evil in every individual. Because I think, you know, in the past, certainly golden age crime fiction, the thing was that, you know, people love crime because it's a battle of good and evil. The detective is the goodie, the killer is the baddie, and will the good defeat the evil? And it was very much seen in terms of good people versus evil people. Now, I don't really believe in good people or evil people. I believe in good and evil in each and every one of us. And so the whole issue of guilt and responsibility and who is actually to blame for the fact that this woman has been murdered, that's really what I wanted to explore. And I love it in terms of, you know, authors always have ideal reactions that they hope people have to their books. I always hope that when people read The Carrier that their main reaction will be, even though I know who did it, I've no idea whose fault it all was. I've no idea. I mean, you know, the murderer may not be the most guilty of the murder. The murderer is probably the least guilty person in terms of that their contribution to the death of the victim. So that's the kind of thing I wanted to explore.
You set up these circumstances where it's the motive is not obvious.
I'm a big believer in that, and I'm glad you spotted it. I really much prefer to write about crimes with what I call non-transferable motives. So there's lots of detective fiction where somebody ends up committing a murder because they want to inherit someone's money, or they're being blackmailed and they want to make sure they're not going to be exposed. So when I first started writing crime fiction, I didn't really think of this, but I eventually, after I'd written two or three crime novels, I realised that the motives in my crime novels were always completely non-transferable. They were a motive that would only apply to that particular person in that particular combination of circumstances. And so now I make it a thing. I won't write a book unless I know I've got a non-transferable motive that's very unusual. And really, that, you know, if the reader wants to try and work it out, or if my detectives want to try and work it out, they can only do it by working out what's going on in that particular individual's mind. And it's always very, very strange and idiosyncratic. I can't give you any examples, unfortunately, because then I'd be giving away the endings of my books, but readers who've read my books will know what I mean by that.
And of course, in this, allegedly no motive, nothing there, but there must be a reason why he would.
Yeah, there's allegedly no motive, and of course he must, whether he's committed the murder or not, which the reader is supposed to wonder, did he or didn't he either has to have a motive for murder, or he has to have a motive for pretending to be a murderer. Which is as big a mystery. You know, why would anyone pretend to be a murderer if they're not?
You mentioned just briefly your characters, your detectives. Can you tell me what keeps you going back to them? Are they people you're still fascinated by? Or at this stage, are they merely a vessel by which you can tell the larger story around it?
Well, they're certainly not merely a vessel. They are series detective characters. Having said that, I do actually feel that my books feel more like standalones than like series, because each book is narrated in the first person by a female protagonist who is unique to that book. And so Gabby, for example, in The Carrier, is the first-person narrator. And so I really feel that each book has more of a sort of standalone psychological thriller feel to it. Now, it just so happens that all my female protagonists need police help, or hindrance, depending on how you look at it. And so I wanted to have regular returning police characters, basically so that readers could get to know them over a longer period of time. You know, I quite like the sort of rhythmic and structural tension between the heroine storyline in each book that has to be a sort of fairly steep and dramatic narrative arc, and then the stories of the detective characters, which are progressing but much more slowly and gently and undramatically, sort of along the bottom. And, you know, they don't have to be concluded by the end of each book, because those characters are going to go on into the next book. And I think putting together one story that has to end within that book and one that's going to go forward into the next is actually, it creates a quite productive sort of rhythmic tension and tautness.
There's a comfort to it as well when you go back to the characters that people know and love and understand a bit more, especially if you're being introduced to new characters or if you're being psychologically attacked.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about, you know, stopping writing about my regular police characters, especially Simon and Charlie, I just don't think I have it in me. I would feel as though I was, you know, they can't exist without me. And the fact is that they do exist. And I'd feel mean if I just stopped them, because, you know, they feel quite real to me now.
Perhaps we can get a top five list of your favorite poetry books. Do you feel that crime and poetry, do they feel like they go together? Or do you feel like your audience...
I mean, I could be wrong. I've never done any market research, but I think they're quite separate. I think poetry lovers, I mean, there may be plenty of people who like poetry and like crime, but I think there's possibly more who like one or the other, so I feel as though it's two different lots of readers. My favourite poetry books, well, one of them would have to be Edna St. Vincent Millay's Collected Sonnets. I think Edna St. Vincent Millay is just a genius, and what I really love about her poetry is, although the diction and the form seems quite archaic and old-fashioned, her subject matter is incredibly modern and contemporary. You know, she writes sonnets about I being born a woman and distressed. And she's addressing a man, a lover, presumably, and she's saying to him, just because I really fancy you and we're about to have sex, please don't think that afterwards I'm going to be interested in you in any way. It's purely physical, and as soon as I've got this sort of physical frenzy out of my system, I'll be quite happy never to have anything to do with you again. So I just love her sort of very honest, candid and refreshing take on relationships, but delivered in this really sort of thee and thou archaic manner. So she's definitely one of my favourites. Then another of my favourites is Robert Frost. I would take his collected poems, definitely. George Herbert. What I like about his poetry is the musical quality of it. I mean, I think just the prosody of his poetry is amazing. Wendy Cope, who is probably my favourite living poet. In fact, she definitely is my favourite living poet. Her subject matter is very similar to Edna St. Vincent Millay, you know, dodgy blokes, miserable relationships. I like reading about that kind of thing. And a new poet called Nick Aubrey. His book is called Small Talk, I think. And it's published by a sort of trendy independent press called Dirty Little Press. But he writes very short, very witty, rhyming verses. I mean, just to give you an example, in fact, one of his poems is in The Carrier. I got permission to... The book is full of poems, because Tim, the romantic hero who may or may not have murdered his wife, is a poetry lover, so I've put in the odd poem that means a lot to Tim. But one of them is this Nick Aubrey poem, which is called The Sommelier and Some Liar. And it goes, knowledgeable nonchalant, I tell the waiter, fine, when really what I'm thinking is, I'm fairly sure it's wine. So he would be my fifth choice.
Thanks, Sophie. Fantastic list of books. Thanks so much. You'll find that and other lists on our website, scottishbooktrust.com. Or, of course, you can follow us on Twitter at ScottishBKTrust. Or like us on Facebook. So, speaking of poetry, we were recently up at the Stanza Poetry Festival, the largest poetry festival in Scotland. And it's in St. Andrews, happens every year, and it's always the highlight of my year as a poet and as a fan of poetry. They're doing a phenomenal job putting together a really, really eclectic and wonderfully diverse program of all sorts of different types of poetry. There's something there for everybody, as well as visual arts, sound installations. It's really fantastic. And the poet we got to meet and sit down with was the great John Hegley. John Hegley, he's a great poet and performer. He's so popular, he hardly needs any introduction. It was a special treat to sit down with him. He starts off by just reading us a little poem.
An ending of the reoffending. For the prisoner paying the price, just a punishment may not suffice. The best use of time may be learning to rhyme, making sure that it isn't too nice a process. Of course, you don't want people thinking a life of crime leads to loads of free poetry workshops.
That poem's from the new book, isn't it, John?
That's from the book Peace, Love and Potatoes. That's one after doing some work in prisons, getting prisoners to write poems. I largely work with school children. I don't share so much experience with prisoners. I share more experience with school children, and so I feel as though I have more to say to them, really.
It ties into a little bit about the book, because I think there's a real going back to your childhood. You know, there's a lot of family in there. You're really circling around that. And I was wondering if that was a conscious choice to delve into that history a little bit more.
I wrote a poem in the last book that was about how Theseus, when he went down to the Minotaur to get... but it was getting. I think it's a bit. It was all a bit brutal. That I don't know whether there could have been some negotiation actually, rather than just going down there armed and ready. You know, and it's the same with George and the Dragon in the English story. They haven't tried negotiation, which is something I talk to kids about sometimes. But that apart, he needed to find his future. He needed to, because he took a ball of twine, and he laid out the twine, and that was the way he got back. But in his that was his past, wasn't it? The twine was his past, but that was the way to his future. So we need to know our past to know to find our future. So it seems, because my brother says to me, well, you're always going on about the family. And I sort of think, which makes it seem as though it's sort of just reliving the past with in a dead way. But for me, it's in a living way, I hope.
It doesn't feel dead at all. It feels very much alive and very
both present and honorific and living and funny as, and charming as well.
The brother-in-law. Well, I can remember that the fact about my brother-in-law that he used to like to stop and ask hitchhikers, and he asked them where they were going and then tell them he'll get there first. And I'll tell you a little thing that's actually about my brother. I say it's about my brother-in-law, but my brother used to do that. I try and remember a bit about Mum. Mummy, when I cut my chin, you came and kept the bleeding in, you held it like it was a purse. Way back once you were a nurse, you cleaned my brother's fencing trophy on the mantel shelf, and you made sure my sister felt a value when unsure of it herself. So I'm unsure of that, but I think we can go with unsureness. It's what I do with youngsters. Be okay to be unsure. Don't feel as though it's wrong to be unsure. You know, we haven't got to retake that, not only because it's a podcast. Generally, I think there's a fear of it not being right, and it's okay if it's not quite right. You strenuously stretched the pound. You even found enough for me to visit distant 4th Division football grounds like Chesterfield and Barrow. This narrow mark upon my chin's a mark of how you held it all together, Mum. Our father's earnings were not large, but you always made sure that we had the best. You kept our dwellings nice and clean. You always made sure that we had the best of margarine. Which I think is something that you as an American may not quite appreciate that, but it resonates, I think, more with English than Scots audiences. I might be wrong. It's a thing about working class to some extent. Or to think about people on lower incomes, not necessarily working class, that margarine, obviously, not as good as butter.
And of course, that repetition of the best, because your mind is already going, what's the best of what? Or just the best, because every parent wants the best for their kid. And the fact, it does that thing of acknowledging where you come from.
What's one of the nice things about this is, although my brother is a little bit critical of, he says I should do half and half. He says, go on about the past, half, you know, make sure it's, you know, that's no more than that, that's enough, which I think's fair, actually, and I've taken that on board. So it's opened up a really nice dialogue with him, which has been a great thing, actually. And he says that Mum and Dad did their best. That's the phrase that he said, actually. He said they did the best they could. Yeah, I've realised that. And also being a dad, and my daughter sometimes stretching my patience, I've realised that I made my efforts to stretch their patience. Yeah. One might look back and say that Mum and Dad didn't have a knowledge of so many things, you know, like literature. They weren't widely read. They didn't have great knowledge of the arts, but they had knowledge of their own, what they wanted to do within their own parameters. And at Christmas time, one of the things that I've sort of come to a sort of balancing point, if you like, is I remember Christmas, and I remember that Dad used to sit there and smoke a cigar, blowing smoke rings, looking over it as though he was satisfied with his kingdom. And it was a small kingdom, but it was in order, in his terms. We now have to make our effort to do that with what we know, what we don't know, to find a position of balance. I mean, that's really, you know, we're only just animals, and that seems to me to be a reasonable animal state for us to aspire to, a bit of balance. A few smoke rings.
Yeah, and I guess there's that feeling of as the world kind of gets bigger and we get more experience in the world. I mean, you travel a lot. I'm all over the place. My parents didn't have that opportunity or luxury. It's easier to be dissatisfied and malcontent. You know, in that smaller space, you could be content. You can find that balance. And not to say it's harder now, but it is. It does sometimes feel difficult.
Well, I've got to ask you why you say it feels difficult for you. I must ask you that.
Yeah, there's so much. There's so much to see. It's hard to be like, oh yeah, I'll just stay here. Very difficult to settle when the entire world is there.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I do Tai Chi, and Tai Chi is physically about being settled. But, and poetry, and I didn't expand upon that last night. When I was introducing the riddles, I said a poem is sometimes a riddle, which is, and sometimes the riddles, you've got absolutely no idea what they are. And sometimes they're riddles that you really can get, but a lot of the time, they're not always riddles, poems. And an interesting thing that a guy at Ledbury Poetry Festival said to me, I forgot, it was one of the chaps who started that festival, said that it's not poetry, but poetries. So I write one sort of poetry, sometimes a few sorts of poetry, but... Yeah. Okay, so what am I? I fly, I slip by, I get wasted. What am I?
Oh, I can remember. This is the point. Time.
Yeah, time flies, time slips by, time gets wasted. Two in a human, four in a lemur. I'm pulling your leg for I'm your...
Femur.
Yeah, femur. This has got a big rhyming clue. I'm stripy. I'm on the beach. I rhyme with neck hair. I'm a...
deck chair.
Deck chair. Okay, another one. I shed light for others. I am on the rocks. And deep inside me, there is a darkness. I shed light for others. I am...
depressed.
I am depressed. But luckily, I've been cheered up by this wonderful festival here at Stanza.
John Hegley, everybody, thanks very much for making the time to sit down with us, and thanks again to Stanza for putting this whole festival together. It cheered him up, cheers me up, cheers everybody up, and in March next year, you'll be able to go again. If you were lucky enough to be there this March, you saw one of the most spectacular poetry festivals. If you think you know the story of how the London Bridge got sold to Americans, and why... you might be surprised by what our next guest has to say. The story starts in Scotland, goes to London, of course, and then travels across the ocean to America. It even features a brief appearance by the great Thomas Paine. It's a fascinating journey. It's both an examination of myth-making and fact-finding. So get ready to be amazed by the story of a bridge.
My name is Travis Elborough, the author of London Bridge in America. In 1967, the Corporation of London put London Bridge up for sale, and the purchasers was an American oil magnate and chainsaw king called Robert P. McCulloch and his associate C.V. Wood. You know, there, since then there's been a lot of speculation about whether these Americans bought even the right bridge, and among gentlemen on bar stools or London cab drivers, you tend to get the impression that they really wanted Tower Bridge, the somewhat more gaudy Gothic creation slightly to the east of London Bridge. But they did, in fact, buy the 1831 London Bridge, which was created by John Rennie, the great Scottish engineer who grew up in kind of a hamlet just outside Edinburgh called Fantasy. Rennie is this kind of monolithic figure in civil engineering, but he was actually dead by the time that his London Bridge was built, and it was built by his sons.
Why do you think the kind of conventional wisdom or like the urban legend is that the Americans had accidentally bought the wrong bridge? Because I always heard the story as a sort of, well, what a bunch of stupid rubes with too much money buying the wrong bridge. How did that kind of rumor get started, or that thing get started? And when did you find out that that wasn't quite accurate? Did you know that from very early on in the project?
The rumor that the Americans had bought the wrong bridge, I think, has a lot to do with British, condescension of our transatlantic cousins, particularly during this period. The British sold at the height, in a way, of the swinging 60s, and when, London was feeling pretty good about itself. But with that, there was also an awareness that lots of the things about the swinging 60s, were just lots of the British film industry, were funded by American money. And there's a general sense of unease about American post-war power and British imperial decline. And I think the bridge somehow or other comes to symbolise that. It ends up being bound up in some of those ideas. I mean, the new London Bridge, the bridge that replaces the one that sold, sort of opens in 1971, at which point the British economy is on the skids. So the idea of the Americans buying the wrong bridge while London is left with a somewhat dull motorway-looking kind of piece of concrete, it takes on a greater sense of urgency at the point when economic prowess and the height of the swinging London thing has gone a bit sour. I'm not sure how when the myth itself started, but it's certainly, as far as I can tell, doesn't seem to emanate much before the late 60s. But I have what I believe is possibly the original source of it, which is in the book, which is involved in an interview that Robert McCulloch Jr., Robert McCulloch's son, gave to the BBC, where he rather jokingly, as an aside, he was asked the direct question, do you have your eye on anything else? And he, just as a joke, said, oh, well, I did ask Mr. King, who was the city engineer in London, whether we could have Tower Bridge, but he said, no, it wasn't for sale. And it's a joke. You can imagine people listening to the Radio 4's Today programme in 1968. There you are with your cornflakes first thing in the morning, or, your bacon and slice, and you hear this kind of half digested with a cup of tea. And then by the end of the evening, in the pub, everyone's going, oh, do you hear those Americans? They wanted to buy Tower Bridge, So I think that's the source of the rumour. How it kind of became, bigger and bigger is bound up in lots of those senses of anxieties about Britain's place in the world after the Second World War and kind of industrial decline and so on. There's a great Scottish fraudster, a character called Arthur Ferguson, who is rumoured to have sold Nelson's Column, Big Ben, and these things. And someone else has researched his story, and he, as far as this person can ascertain, the story about Ferguson doesn't really come into existence. The earliest reference to it is in the early 70s, again, when the prowess of the British imperial dream has entirely kind of evaporated. I mean, if you think about it, 1966 is when England win the World Cup. You know, Mexico 1970 is when there are accusations of shoplifting, and they leave in defeat. And so there's a lots of between those two things. A bridge is sold. So I think there are some kind of anxieties about the sense of place.
At one point in the introduction, I don't know if it's you quoting somebody else or you just saying, you called it a piece of junk.
Well, I think a common perception among people, I mean, the bridge is sold by the City of London Corporation, most of whom think this is just a pile of old stones inhibiting Ford Anglias from getting across the River Thames. They don't think of it as one of the last creations of John Rennie, the magnificent Scottish civil engineer, responsible for, ball bearings, gantry planes, the London docks, you name it. This huge array of civic projects that he produces in his very busy life. Time. And that's another strand I try to deal with in the book, is this idea of preservation and heritage. Just a few years before London Bridge is put up for sale, that one of the most infamous cases of the destruction of something which is considered to have architectural interest is the Euston Arch, this great Doric entranceway to Euston Station, which the British Transport Commission want to get rid of because they want to modernise Euston Station and turn it into this rather sleek airport-style kind of terminal. And despite a huge campaign by people like John Betjeman, Nicholas Pevsner, and even brutalist architects like the Smithsons to save this arch, it is destroyed. There's a sense that at that point still that, progress is progress. And by about 1967, that's slightly turned. There's a Preservation Act passed which allows things of architectural historic interest to be preserved. And London Bridge, they actually come out and say, we could have broken it up and the rest of it, but we think it's unbecoming of this monument not to, to try and sell it as a complete piece. So that's a complete change of opinion from only 4 years earlier. So that the bridge is also is about that, really. I mean, it's a book, so therefore one is keen to make the object what you're describing as kind of as potent a symbol as possible. But it is, it's very emblematic of traffic, whether that's cross river traffic in London or the bigger scheme in a way of it being this emblematic thing about transcontinental traffic, that ideas come back and forth. I mean, the part of the reason why Rennie's bridge was commissioned was because of a bridge that was built up in Sunderland, the Weir Mouth Bridge, which in turn was inspired by an iron bridge design that Thomas Paine had brought back from America, and described the mightiness of the American landscape as being how it conceived of this idea of this iron bridge, which he originally wanted to have built in Philadelphia, but he couldn't get enough funds for it. So he comes over to France and then to London to look for sites and backers to build this iron bridge. It's exhibited outside a pub in Paddington. It's praised at the time, this kind of this model version of it, and his ambition is for it to be erected over the Thames. But then the French Revolution kicks off and he ends up being drawn back into politics. There are lots of weird transcontinental, transatlantic strands with this book and this bridge.
You went to Arizona, right? You went Havasu. What was it like for you as somebody who lives in London to end up in essentially the desert and see this piece of your city's history?
It's quite an extraordinary experience because you move through this quite desolate, it has a kind of a monotonous kind of beauty, the Mojave Desert landscape. I suppose they almost look prehistoric, some of the landscape, or it looks like the surface of the moon might look like. At the base of the bridge, there is something which is called the English Village, which is a mock version of a ye olde World of England type come London Cockney village, which boasts a fountain which is loosely modelled on the one in Trafalgar Square with these Lilliputian Landseer lions. They're built in Mexico, I learned. There's a red telephone box. This was actually owned for a time by the Corporation of London as part of the sale deal. But the English Village itself is looking rather sorry. The pub is boarded up and it's all set to be redeveloped. But the bridge itself looks rather lovely. Rennie's design was, in the neoclassical style. And in old postcards of it in London, it tends to look a bit dull. It's the bridge that T.S. Eliot, you know, includes in The Wasteland. That's what he's observing. It's that same bridge. But it actually looks rather impressive, and it looks quite grand.
What is the impression of the people who live in that place, of this bridge? I mean, you must have met a lot of people when you told them you were doing a story on the bridge. Were they like, oh yeah, I'd be interested in that? Or were they like, that's just a stupid bridge?
When I met some of the earliest residents, there's a really lovely local museum called the Lurk Havasey Museum of History, and it's staffed largely by some of the people who've been there, some of the oldest residents who do refer to themselves as pioneers, because before 1963, there was literally nothing there. People were living in tents. Today, you know, it's home to about 53,000 people, which wasn't as many as McCulloch hoped. He wanted something around 100,000, but it succeeded as a new town in a way that many of that era didn't. And they all credit, you know, the bridge with putting them on the map and, and creating this buzz of interest.
Travis Elborough, everybody. Go get his book, London Bridge in America. You won't regret it. It's a fascinating story. And you can check out his website as well. He's got loads of information about his other projects, as well as photographs and book trailers and tunes about the London Bridge, all of that kind of stuff. TravisElborough.co.uk. Check it out. So there's a big event happening in Edinburgh soon, one of the highlights of our calendar year. The Edinburgh Science Festival. A lot of scientists happen to write books, and we've pored over the Science Festival brochure. We've looked into the program very, very deeply, and I think we've identified some of the best, most interesting book-related material there. Though I should say, there's an awful lot of really, really interesting stuff there, and you should go to everything that the Science Festival is doing. You're going to want to go see Mark Thompson. You probably saw him on TV with Stargaze Live with Brian Cox. He's talking about astronomy and how you can get involved. You can go to see that on the 27th of March. He's got a new book out. Dr. Kevin Fong, Fit for Orbit, is the name of the event. It's on the 5th of April. And his book, of course, was Extremes, Life, Death, and the Human Body. And he's looking at how space travel can affect the human body. You might think twice about getting on that rocket ship to Mars. Thomas Thwaites, this guy's brilliant. He decided to build household items out of, just by himself, to see how complicated something as simple as a toaster is. His book is called The Toaster Project. His event is called The Toaster Project. And he's going to talk about how hard it is to build something that we think of as incredibly simple. That event is on at the 6th of April. Go check it out. And finally, a saucy sounding one. Like a Virgin is the name of the event. The book is called Like a Virgin, How Science is Redesigning the Rules of Sex. Go to that event. Find out what's happening with your own body. That's with Arathi Prasad. That's on the 29th of March. It's going to be a cracker. And that's just a selection of all the events that are going to be there at the Science Festival. You're going to be able to listen. You're going to be able to get your hands dirty. You're going to want to go to the website, sciencefestival.co.uk. And the festival starts on the 23rd of March and runs all the way to the 7th of April. We'll see you there. So that's it for this episode of Bookmarked. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. And dip into the Scottish Book Trust website. There's loads of fantastic resources on there. ScottishBookTrust.com. You can follow us on Twitter at ScottishBUKTrust or like us on Facebook. It's been a pleasure being with you, and we'll have more book goodness for you soon. Bookmarked is produced by Colin Fraser with music from Ragland.
Thanks for listening to this Scottish Book Trust podcast. Find more book lists, stories, and interview blogs at ScottishBookTrust.com and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter.